This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer, and Kyle Mabry is at the controls. Coming up in this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with Misha Glenny. He's a former BBC correspondent, and he has a new book out that looks at cybercrime, and we'll be talking about that with him and taking your questions. We want to take a moment here first, though, to remind you that this is a time we need your support. In fact, you know, when you look at how it is we pay the bills here at WILL, the listeners, folks like you, are really the most reliable source of income we have. Yes, we do have some federal support, but that's really shrunk over the years. And so more and more, to pay for the programs that you value, well, we're turning to you. This is one of those times that we talk about it directly, in a very direct way, and try to remind you that your support helps keep this place going. Helps keep it a strong local radio service. So if you if that's something you appreciate, now's the time to act. To go to the phone, make a pledge, go online, make a pledge. One or the other way, we hope that you will do it. Take this opportunity here really before we get into the conversation with Misha Glenny. Amy Stewart Ray is in the studio with me to help in persuading people to go to the phone and dial up that number.
Absolutely. And that number is 217-244-9455. Or you can go to your computer, point your browser to willpledge.org. But yes, I just received an update a little while ago from Rita Schulte. We are at 220 pledges received so far, which goes a long way toward our goal of 1,200 pledges for this membership drive. So thank you to those of you who have reached out so far. But we're still waiting to hear from some of you. Please call 217-244-9455.
This is a program we've been doing the show for a long time. As people maybe know, we've been on the air. This show has been on the air 30 years this year. Some of the programs we do, like the first hour, are how-to kind of shows. You know, the idea is we have some specific issue, and we know people have questions about how they deal with that. But then there are other programs that we hope will just help you understand the world a little bit better, introduce you to ideas that may not completely be in sync with yours. And we say, well, you know, think about this. I mean, you don't have to agree with the guest. You can even call in and tell the guest you think that they're all wet. I mean, and that's fine. But the idea is, you know, we want to give you some things to think about. You know, you make up your mind. Well, now we hope that one thing we don't have to get you to struggle to think about is what this station means to you.
Absolutely.
That it's here when you want it. When you turn the radio on, it's here.
It's a valuable resource that you know that you can count on.
Absolutely. You know. So we know you're counting on us. Well, now we're saying to you, well, we're counting on you. We're counting on you to help keep the station strong. And that's what you're doing when you make a contribution.
Absolutely. And David was just talking about the mission of Focus, really, which is to enlighten and inform its listeners. And that really is the mission of public radio in general. And if that's something that you value, if that's something that you support, please call 217-244-9455 or go to your computer and pull up the website willpledge.org and show us that public radio is something that you value and want to continue here in Central Illinois.
All right. Thanks very much. Well, this is Focus, our morning talk show. Glad to have you listening in. I'm David Inge. You know, so much of the way that we live today, the way that we work, the way we play, the way we communicate, so much of that is regulated by computers. The benefits of this certainly are great, but so are the dangers. In this part of the show, we have as our guest Misha Glenny. He is a former Central Europe correspondent for the BBC, and we will be talking about a book that he's authored. The title of the book is Dark Market, Cyber Thieves, Cyber Cops, and You. It's just recently out. It's published by Knopf. He's spending some time talking about the show, and it takes a look at one of the biggest threats that faces us in the modern digital age, and that's cyber crime. Quite an interesting book. It's out now, again, as I say, and he's traveling around talking about the book, and he's giving us some time today. We're really pleased that he could talk with us. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll-free 800-222-9455. If you'd like to call in with a question, you can certainly do that, or we do have email, and that's will-talk@illinois.edu. And Misha Glenny, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm very well.
Good.
If I might, I'll just take this opportunity, and this is entirely spontaneous, to support your pledge drive as a former BBC correspondent. I have to say that the value of an editorial independent public radio in these turbulent times is exceptionally important, both in the United Kingdom, the United States, and elsewhere.
Well, I thank you very kindly. There it is, folks, from direct from Michigan. This is such an interesting subject, this subject of cybercrime, and I gather that it grows out of the some of the kind of reporting that you had done before, and really that people can read in an earlier book that you wrote. In fact, we talked about it here on the show, McMafia, about organized crime around the world. How did you get introduced to the topic of cybercrime?
Well, that's right. I mean, what happened was that I was, of course, concentrating as Central Europe correspondent on the revolutions in Eastern Europe and the aftermath, and then the wars in Yugoslavia. And increasingly, I found when I was talking about politics in those regions in the turbulent years after the collapse of communism, that I could not avoid talking about organized crime as well, as there was a grab for assets in the new world of the market economy around the region. And that's what sparked my interest in organized crime. And, of course, organized crime was not just restricted to Eastern Europe and the Balkans. It was developing as a globalized phenomenon as well, which is what led me to write McMafia. For McMafia, I went to Brazil, where, of course, the sort of traditional forms of organized crime are things like trafficking in narcotics and very significant gang culture. But what I discovered there was that it was also a thriving area, in fact, one of the global centers of cybercrime, which I hadn't expected. And so I investigated cybercrime there, spoke to some active criminal hackers who I managed to run down, and they were very helpful, and also the federal cyber police in Brasilia, who had busted their colleagues, the cyber criminals' colleagues who they'd previously worked with. And then I also spoke to a man named Peter Aller, who was down in Brazil working with his company, ISS, which is a security firm run out of Atlanta, Georgia, that's now owned by IBM. And he was a former CIA officer who had gone over to the private sector. And he described to me the emerging arms race going on in cyber between various criminal organizations, espionage groups, even states, which both the corporate and the private sector in the United States were beginning to wake up to. So when I heard all of this, I said, right, I've got to write about cybercrime for the next book. But, well, that's as you point out, it's a very, very interesting subject. There is a problem that you face as a writer if you're dealing with computers, and that is, for most people, the ins and outs and the technical details of computer technology is actually a very dry, boring subject. And as a writer, you've got to find a way to make it interesting. So rather than I checked out all the Hollywood movies which purport to have computers at their center over the past 20 years, from that great movie War Games onwards. And what I noticed was that whilst computers are supposedly at the heart of these films, they actually only make up about 1 or 2% of screen time of the whole film. And the rest of it are just standard Hollywood thriller narratives. So what I decided to do was to attempt to write a book about cybercrime in which I didn't talk about computers very much, but concentrated instead on the personalities, the psychology, the weirdness, the diversity of people actively engaged in cybercrime. And so those are the people I spoke to in order to reconstruct the story of Dark Market, along with the cyber cops who were chasing them digitally all around the world.
Yeah. Well, one of the striking things here that you write about it is that, and we can talk about how much money we're talking about here, while on one hand, there are enormous amounts of money to be made, and people do, in doing illegal things involving computers and the Internet, that when you talk with the individuals, people who have been involved in doing the hacking, that really, it's for them, it's not primarily about money.
Well, there are different subtypes of people involved in cybercrime. There are the hackers, the ones with real digital skills, really advanced computing ability, and those are the ones who I think you're referring to here, in as much that when I started to meet these people and interview them at length, I found that there were some striking characteristics that they shared, behavioral traits. So first of all, they all became involved in computing and indeed hacking when they were in their early teens, between about the ages of 13 and 15. Secondly, they all demonstrated a considerable ability in math or science, and in particular physics. Thirdly, they were usually obsessed by gaming when they first started. And what this meant is that they became involved in this type of trade at an early age, before their moral compass had really developed. And what they were looking for on the Internet was not money. They were looking for status. They were looking for the sort of status on the Internet that they were failing to find in the real world, because the characteristics that they generally demonstrated amounted to something, in some cases, quite literally as Asperger's syndrome, and in most cases, something close to Asperger's or some other form of spectrum disorder. Now, those are the ones who generally were not doing it for the money, but for the status and for the joy of working in an environment that they adored. But behind them, there is a more sinister type of cyber criminal whose primary skill, and this is the primary skill required for most cybercrime, is not a digital ability, but what I refer to and what's known as social engineering. That is the ability to persuade people to do things on their computer which is actually not in their own interest. So, and the most basic form, to persuade them to click on a link in a spam email, which the clicking of which will lead to your computer being infected. And those are the real sort of masterminds in cybercrime who are closer to traditional organized crime than the hackers and geeks who provide the technical facilitation of the whole thing. Mm.
To just introduce again our guest for this hour, we're talking with Misha Glenny, his former BBC Central Europe correspondent. He covered the fall of communism and the wars in the former Yugoslavia. He is the author of a book about international organized crime, McMafia, and also a new book that is about cybercrime that really grew out of a lot of the research that he did about international organized crime. The new book is titled Dark Market, Cyber Thieves, Cyber Cops, and You. Knopf is the publisher. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Certainly, cybercrime is a threat. It's a threat to individuals. It is a threat to businesses. And on a state-to-state level, it can also be a threat to governments. What's really hard, though, it makes it difficult to get a handle on this, is that perpetrators aren't going to advertise their activities, and often the victims don't want to say that they have been victimized. So that it sounds as if that really makes it hard for anybody to get a grip on how big a problem this is and what kind of money that we're talking about.
Well, you're absolutely right about that, and this is a very big problem. Let me explain why. We had, for example, about 4 weeks ago, the White House issued a statement regarding cybercrime and other forms of what I refer to as malfeasance on the web. And they said that it was damaging the global economy to the tune of $1 trillion a year. Now, this figure has actually just been plucked out of the air because, as you point out, we do not have a proper way of measuring how much damage it's doing to the economy. The primary reason for this is twofold. One is that people often don't know that they're victims of cybercrime, and cybercrime can be perpetrated, small amounts of money, for example, being siphoned out of an account over a long period of time, but over many, many accounts. And the other thing is that individuals often don't know what to do when reporting cybercrime. Quite frequently, if they ring up the local police are equally clueless as to what to do. And then on the much larger corporate level, companies are extremely reluctant to announce that they have suffered a data breach of any source because of the reputational loss that this involves. And as yet, we do not have around the world clear statutory requirements, mandates to report data breaches. Now, what that means by implication is that because we don't know how much money we're losing as a consequence of this activity, it means that we cannot measure the risk accurately, so that a secondary insurance market through which you can insure yourself against that risk is not yet emerging. And that means that companies and corporations are generally on their own when it comes to assessing what their security requirements are. This makes it very difficult for them to decide on investment, combined with the fact that temporarily we have a generational problem, in as much that most board members are still over the age of 55 or so, and they don't yet get quite how serious this issue is, and how security can no longer be just about a couple of guys in the basement who come and turn your computer on and off when it goes wrong, but it has to be layered into a company from the very bottom right up to the top. And this is a matter of long-term education, which we aren't yet grappling with.
Yeah. One of the parts of the story that I think is also fascinating and kind of stunning is that people have set up websites where criminals do things like they sell credit card numbers, they sell equipment to be used in crime, they exchange tips on cybercrime techniques. They're like criminal supermarkets. One of them was actually, and you take your title of the book, one of them was actually called Dark Market, which was closed down, I believe, in 2008. But I'm sure that there are also other people who are still operating these kind of businesses online.
That's right. I mean, it's quite funny. When you said that the criminals don't advertise themselves, that's true up to a point, but they do advertise themselves in their community. Yeah. So the first of these extraordinary sort of online superstores for criminals was founded in Odessa in Ukraine in 2001. It was called Carta Planet. And they actually released around the web a series of very sophisticated digital adverts encouraging criminals to come and use their services. And Carta Planet was incredibly important because what it did, so you became a member, and when you logged in, it was looking like any other discussion forum about on the net, you know, a discussion forum about parenting or a discussion forum about beekeeping, except this was, as you say, discussion forum where you could buy and sell stolen credit card details, where you could purchase the latest malware, viruses, trojans, and worms, and then deploy them, where you could hire so-called botnets, an army of enslaved computers which you can use in denial-of-service attacks, or you can download tutorials on how to teach yourself the latest tricks in cybercrime. But the chief reason why Carta Planet was revolutionary and it industrialized cybercrime on the web and holds a very special place in the hearts of cybercriminals is that they overcame the central challenge which faces any criminal working on the web. And that challenge is, how can I trust the guy that I'm doing business with when it's axiomatic that he's untrustworthy because he's a criminal? And Carta Planet, the administrators who ran the site, came up with this scheme called the escrow system, whereby they would act as honest brokers, as it were, among thieves, so that if you were selling credit cards, you would send your credit card details, stolen credit card details, to the escrow officer, and the purchaser would send the money, and the escrow officer would test around the world in ATMs a random sample of these credit card details, and if they worked, he'd keep that money for himself as a fee for the for providing the escrow office, and he would then release the money to the vendor and the credit card details to the purchaser. And this meant that fraud over the internet went global. And as you say, it culminated in Dark Market, one of the biggest ever English language criminal websites. And what the story of the book is about is that there was a very enterprising agent of the FBI who went undercover on the web, a sort of Donnie Brasco of the internet, and he managed to infiltrate the leadership of Dark Market and become one of its administrators. And the story of the book is the sort of cops and robber chase around the world, the battle of wits between the cyber cops and the cyber thieves, which I've reconstructed by having interviewed all the guys involved, the main guys involved, certainly. So, but once Dark Market was taken down, actually, that did send cyber criminals deeper into the underground. You still get these forums in other languages, in Russian, Indonesian, Turkish. They're more difficult for people like the FBI and the Secret Service to penetrate. But in terms of the English language criminal scene, that has gone further underground and it has become much more sophisticated. Generally, the criminals are always one large step ahead of the cyber cops.
Yeah. Well, that's it. And I'm sure that for law enforcement, it's made difficult by the fact that you can have the criminals can be in one country and they can be taking advantage of people in a second country, and they could somehow be going through computers in some third country, and then they could park their money in some fourth country, so that then not only does the business of investigating become very much more complicated, but then as far as law enforcement is concerned, then you have these complicated questions of jurisdiction. That is, well, who in what country is it their responsibility to pursue these criminals?
This is absolutely right. Let me tell you the really rather tragic story of an Australian man, Roger Mildenhall. Roger Mildenhall was from Perth in Western Australia, where he had bought two houses as his pension plan, effectively, and was otherwise working in South Africa. And last early September, he got a call from his neighbor, one of his neighbors in Perth, who said, Roger, we can understand why you sold the first house, but why are you selling the second house as well? And Mr. Mildenhall said, what are you talking about? I haven't sold either of the houses. And he got in touch with the real estate agent who had apparently sold these houses, and it was confirmed they had sold the first house. And what it had then emerged after investigations had happened is that a hacker from Nigeria had managed to hack into his Yahoo account that he was using in South Africa. And in this account, he had found the title deeds to the houses in Western Australia. The hacker had then emailed, using the Yahoo account, the real estate agent in Perth and instructed them to sell the first house, which they did for $350,000, Australian dollars, and this was then transferred to China from where the money was laundered from a Chinese bank. And all this had happened without Mr. Mildenhall having a clue about it until he got that phone call. So the issue for Mr. Mildenhall was there were two issues about this. First of all, who is responsible for investigating that crime? Is it the Nigerian police, where the scammer came from? Is it the South African police, where Mr. Mildenhall was based? Is it the United States law enforcement agencies, because Yahoo.com comes under American jurisdiction because of the domain name? Is it the Australian police, where obviously everything happened? Or is it the Chinese police, from where the money was laundered? And the answer is, of course, in the case of that complexity, there is no way that police can coordinate a proper investigation. The other second point, which Mr. Mildenhall pointed out, is that although the real estate agent had received documents from his email account, including the title deeds to the house, nowhere had they seen his signature. And what this means is they had gone ahead with instructions to sell the house without seeing Mildenhall's signature. And that speaks to another problem in the web, that we have become so reliant on the web that, and it's become such an everyday thing, that we don't do the basics. Our behavior has become really, really sloppy. And that behavioral development is a golden opportunity for people engaged in fraud or crime on the internet.
Yeah, that just seems staggering that this business, and if I was this man, I would say, yeah, my first place that I'm going to go after is the realtor that, without seeing my signature on anything, went ahead and sold a property.
And believe you me, that is happening.
But this it really does come down to the question for individuals that we, all of us, have to take responsibility for our own security and have some idea what best practice is, and to the extent that we can do it, to act that way.
We really, really do. And this is for our own benefit, but also for our collective benefit. Now, the problem, and why I decided to write the book with a strong narrative the way that I did, so that it's an exciting read, is that until now, the issue of cybersecurity and cybercrime, cyber industrial espionage, and indeed cyber warfare, has been communicated largely in a language that, frankly, for the vast majority of humanity, is arcane. We simply cannot understand it, and our eyes glaze over. And so what we have to do, those of us who are involved in the media and those of us who are involved in writing and other forms of communication, is to find a language that is accessible for most people so they can start to understand what they need to do in order to protect themselves. Now, help for this will, I hope, come from industry and from the banks as well, although until now that help has been sadly lacking. So we have a situation, for example, at the moment in the United Kingdom, where if you bank with HSBC and your bank account is hacked into and your account compromised and money taken, HSBC will not compensate for you for that if you have failed to download and install their approved authentication system. It's called Rapport. And I think that's a good thing for HSBC to do, because it means that you have to understand that you have a certain responsibility on the way you behave on the net. But I would like to see that type of responsibility extended to include companies, and in particular banks as well, in the same way, so that if a bank is subject to a major data breach, then its executives and its directors must bear direct responsibility for their failure to provide adequate security for their clients and customers. So, for example, after dark market came down, we saw an increase around the world in banks attempting to beef up their security a bit, because they were unbelievably lax in the first decade of this century, particularly in the United States and Canada. So many banks were skinned for tens, hundreds of millions of dollars through sheer lax security. Citibank is regarded as having some of the finest security in the U.S. banking sector at the moment. And yet a couple of months ago, Citibank was hacked into and lost the account details of 200,000 clients. Now, if that is the best banking security you have in the United States at the moment, I dread to think what the less well-prepared banks are like. And so it's not just individuals who have to get their act together and who have to learn ways of dealing with these problems. It is corporations and banks as well, and they need to bear responsibility too.
We're talking this morning with Misha Glenny. He is the author of a new book that's about cybercrime. The title of his book is Dark Market. It's just out now, and we will talk more after a short break. This is Focus.
Support comes from Meyer Drapery Services. Specializing in custom draperies since 1972, Meyer Drapery offers more than 1 million linear yards of drapery material in their two local wholesale warehouses and retail outlet at 330 North Neal in downtown Champaign. Installation and design services are also available.
There are many businesses that support this station, but you know, listener support provides the biggest single source of funding for WILL. That's what makes shows like this one possible. We're now at one of those times of the year we ask for people's support. We hope by the end of the month we will have raised $210,000. And to do that, we're asking you to be one of 1,200 who give us a call and make a pledge this week. The number is 217-244-9455. Or you can go online to willpledge.org, and we would appreciate it if you'd do that today. In this hour of Focus, we are talking with Misha Glenny. He is former BBC Central Europe correspondent. He covered the fall of communism and also the wars in the former Yugoslavia. He's the author of a book about international organized crime, McMafia is the title, and he talked with us about that book a couple of years ago. You can find that interview on our website. His new book is about cybercrime. The title is Dark Market, Cyber Thieves, Cyber Cops, and You. And it's published by Knopf, and it is out now. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things that you also talk about in the book, and I want to make sure we talk a little bit about, is cyber warfare. And I think it has been some time now, there have been people warning the U.S. government, for example, that there would be other governments and non-state groups that would be interested in doing warfare in cyberspace. And in fact, now the Department of Defense has finally come out and said that they consider cyberspace to be a field of operations for them, and have gone as far as to say, we're going to consider a cyber attack on the U.S. to be an act of war, and we might well respond in the real world, not in the cyber world. How far do we know exactly whether in fact stuff like this is now going on?
Yes, we do. As you point out, the United States has established the U.S. Cyber Command, thereby implying and indeed establishing the fifth military domain to go along with land, sea, air, and space. And this, of course, bizarrely and fascinatingly, is the first ever man-made military domain. But we have seen really since 2007, when we had the first sort of major coordinated cyber assault emanating from one country, Russia, onto another, the tiny Baltic state of Estonia. We have seen increasing concern and increasing amounts of money being channeled into cyber defenses, but also into cyber offensive weaponry. And one of the things we have to understand is that although it's really useful for us to grasp what is going on, to split up the areas of bad stuff on the web into three main categories of cybercrime, cyber industrial espionage, and then cyber warfare, these three pillars, unfortunately, have a tendency to melt into each other, partly because hackers are required in all three pillars, and they often migrate between the three pillars, as does one other human agency, and that is the intelligence agent, who is also to be found poking around cyber criminal websites, espionage activities, and also major security issues as well. Now, the other thing that has happened in the past 15 months or so is the emergence and the identification of the Stuxnet virus. The Stuxnet virus infected, as its targets, successfully two uranium enrichment facilities at Natanz and Bushehr in Iran. Even though these weren't on the web, they were offline, which means that whoever infected those two plants had to secrete the virus into the plant, probably using a memory stick. But what Stuxnet did was to interfere with the regulating the pump that sent water around the uranium enrichment facility. And had it not been spotted, it could have resulted in a nuclear explosion. And the reason why that is important is that this is the first evidence that the really nasty stuff that can attack the so-called critical national infrastructure, by which, of course, we mean power, telecoms, utility, financial institutions like the stock exchange and so on, that means that they're out there. But not only are they out there, because it was such a sophisticated virus, it is generally agreed that this had to be constructed by a state, an intelligence agency, a government, a military, whoever it was. I'm not actually at the moment very interested in that. What I'm interested in is the fact that somebody has said, we have got this dangerous technology and we are prepared to deploy it. And once Stuxnet, the truth about Stuxnet came out, then governments all over the world started accelerating their developments of cyber offensive weaponry. And so it's now not just the US, China, and Russia which is doing this stuff. It's about 100 countries in the world. And there is, of course, no guarantee that any of these countries won't at some point decide to fiddle around with it in the real world and release it into cyberspace the way that whoever manufactured Stuxnet decided to do it in Iran last year.
Well, this is an interesting question because I think that we know that governments have been using computers and the internet to spy, to try to gather information on other governments, what they're doing, and I'm confident that they have also been using it to do industrial espionage. But in this particular case, one wonders whoever it was that was responsible, and I think some people have pointed fingers in particular directions, you know, why it is they would have, they didn't come right out and say, we, country A, did this, but someone wanted it known that this is out there. And in fact, right. I think some people have argued that they provided little hints as to who it is that was responsible.
The discussions to which you're alluding are fairly simple. Is that most people suspect that Israel was behind this. Mm-hmm. Some people suspect the combination of Israel and the United States. Some people have suggested to me from the intelligence community that it was developed in the United States and was stolen by Israel. And then there is a minority body of opinion amongst technical experts who also argue that using the technical evidence available, China was responsible for Stuxnet. And so, to be perfectly frank about it, we're thinking it's either Israel or China. But one of the great problems about the internet and the weaponry that can be deployed on the internet is you still cannot identify with 100% certainty or confidence what the origin of a particular weapon might be. And this makes the problem of how you respond to a potential attack on your critical national infrastructure really complex in terms of military theory and practice, because it could be that North Korea decided to launch an attack against the United States but disguise it so that it looked as though the attack came from China. So if you were then to respond with conventional weapons, as has been proposed by the Pentagon, and you hit China, and it turns out to have been North Korea who planted the virus or whatever it was, then you're in a bit of a pickle. In fact, you're in a very, very big pickle.
It's begins to sound like a James Bond film.
Well, strangely, when you start to investigate it, there was one guy who I spoke to about it who's involved in this sort of thing, and he said to me, you cannot imagine what's going on the web. He said it's like a game of seven-dimensional chess, and you're never entirely sure who your opponent is.
We have just about 10 minutes or so in this part of Focus. I just want to, again, quickly introduce our guest, Misha Glenny. He's a journalist. He worked for a number of years for the BBC. He was their Central Europe correspondent. He has a new book out that explores this area that we're talking about, the area of cybercrime. His book is titled Dark Market, and it's published by Knopf. And if someone wanted to call in with a question, they could do that, 333-9455, a toll-free 800-222-9455. You talked a little bit earlier in the first part of the interview about how you had had the opportunity to sit down and talk with some individuals, some hackers, to try to get a sense of who they were and what their motivation was. Is there a particular person, for example, that as a fascinating character that you met just stands out?
Well, two or three of them stand out. One of them is the extraordinary American hacker Max Butler, originally from Meridian, Idaho. And Max in the late 1990s was a very gifted and very able penetration tester in California, worked out of Santa Clara. And a penetration tester is somebody who is paid by companies who attempt to penetrate their systems so that they can see how vulnerable they are. And Max also worked voluntarily for the FBI. Now, in 1998, Max uncovered a vulnerability in all U.S. government systems called the Bind Demon vulnerability. And he then, out of patriotism, he did his duty, and he patched up this vulnerability so that other people like the Chinese or the Russian governments would not be able to exploit it in places, for example, like the Livermore Nuclear Research Lab. So this was really a great thing that he did. But unfortunately, being a sort of congenital and inveterate hacker, he left a tiny little wormhole in these systems that only he knew how to crawl through. And this was spotted by a cyber investigator from the U.S. Air Force, and he landed up in an open prison in California for 2 years. He got a two-year sentence. Now, the other people who were in this prison were basically financial fraudsters. And they couldn't believe their luck that this goose had been plonked on them who laid golden eggs, basically, so that when he came out of prison with a conviction, so he couldn't get a job in security, he was given an apartment, a fancy new computer, and anything he wanted by two of these fraudsters who persuaded him to become the hacker Iceman. And as Iceman, he was one of the most gifted internet criminals of all, eventually caught in 2007, and he's now serving a 13-year sentence in Lompoc, California. Now, this guy has a planetary-sized brain, and it is actually my belief that for the United States, it's a real waste of their resources that this guy who is so gifted is just sitting doing nothing in a prison, and particularly because, I mean, he shows a fair few of the characteristics of spectrum disorder. He is somebody who requires rehabilitation, who could assist the United States and certainly the cybersecurity industry in many, many ways. But we haven't yet adjusted to the nature of this crime and how it relates to our criminal justice system, either here or in the United Kingdom and elsewhere in Western Europe. And this is something that I argue we urgently need to do. These people have incredible skills, but they also have social and psychological disabilities which require understanding and which require help, and they don't require exclusively long prison sentences and then a ban from working in the security industry.
See, that's just right on the face of it seems so obvious that if you were interested in trying to enhance your security, whether you were a government or you were a business, that somebody like that with demonstrated expertise would be the kind of person that you would have working for you. And the idea that you would say, well, this guy's been in jail, we can't hire him, that just doesn't make any sense at all.
It doesn't make any sense, but it is what's happening. And one of the things that I'm hoping to do through this book, with this book myself, is to assist some of these guys when they come out of prison, because they're not going to get any help from the state at all. And so I'm starting to work with a few not-for-profit organizations particularly those engaged in trying to uncover corruption and stuff like that in the United Kingdom, because they are under relentless and very sophisticated hack attacks all the time from governments and corrupt institutions which want to get hold of to see what data they're sitting on. And I want to try and get some of these guys pooling their resources together to help non-profit organizations who can't afford expensive digital solutions to the hacking issue, and so that even if the state and the private sector isn't going to be interested in these guys when they come out of jail, that they will be able to do a really worthwhile job and get paid for the one thing that they can do, which is use computers.
Yeah, you think if you could set up something like Dark Market and offer your services to people who want to break the law, why not set up some organization where you would offer your services to people who are trying to protect themselves from people who would want to try to break the law?
Absolutely, and it will give them, it will give the hackers involved a real sense of value, because they will really be performing a good deed, and it will be recognized. And what they really want is that recognition and that sense of value.
Yeah, and I suppose that there's sort of another way that you could get at this. It's maybe the idea would make people uncomfortable that you would do this kind of profiling, but that would be to, if you have a sense of who the kind of people are that grow up to be hackers, that maybe you try to get at them before they graduate to committing crime, and that then you could take advantage of their abilities and channel them into more legal activities.
Yeah, it's of course difficult. This, it's I think it's something that we should be considering and trying to work out how we can do it. Of course, monitoring school children and their ability for possible deployment in security is almost slightly creepy, the whole thing. So although it's something that I think we ought to do, I haven't got over the sort of creepy aspect to it yet. I'm not quite sure what to do.
Yeah, that goes. We'll build that into our movie about the government who launches the attack on the United States and then persuades the United States it was some other government, and we end up having World War III.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, we're sort of coming down to the point. We have a couple of minutes left. I guess it's probably worth reinforcing a point we made earlier. Actually, even here on the show earlier in the week, we had someone here from the university talking about cybersecurity basics for individuals.
Yeah,
that it's just so important for people to think before they click, because there are all kinds of people out there who that's what they're trying to get you to do. They're trying to click on. Trying to get you to click on something that then they can use that to get at you or your information or get into your computer.
Yeah, that's exactly what they're trying to do. Now, there are all sorts of things that you can do, and I hope your colleague from the university spelled them out. I'm sure he or she did. You cannot run a Windows-based computer now without antivirus software. If you do, you'll be shot down within 24 hours by the simple so-called drive-by malware. There's countless viruses which are circulating around the web robotically, and they will get you. You'll be done. So you have to have that antivirus software. You have to update antivirus packages when requested. You have to update Microsoft Word and the other software that you use on your net when security patches become available. And if you don't, you will be done. So that's just a basic ABC. But then you have to train yourself on recognizing emails which are scams and emails which aren't. And I would argue as well that if you see that a friend or a relative of yours has sent you an email, which is obviously a scam, telling you that they're in Madrid and they've lost their passport and wallet and can you send them $500 to this account, that when you see that, what you should do is immediately email your friend or relative and say, your account has been hacked, it is being used for a spam email, clean out the account, get rid of it, redo your computer, give it an antivirus scan, and so on and so forth, and do it now. Because if we respond like that, then we can assist through, sort of collective security in lowering the impact of these of these phishing scams, which are the most sort of numerous so-called high-volume, low-impact crimes, but which are a real pain in the butt.
Well, that's where we're going to have to leave it. And it's a very, very interesting story. There's much more here in the book that we mentioned a couple of times. And I will mention one more, a time that if you'd like to read on this subject, the book to look at is Dark Market, Cyber Thieves, Cyber Cops, and You. That's the subtitle, by our guest, Misha Glennie. That's published by Knopf, just out now. Also, if you're interested in the subject of international organized crime, you might also look at his earlier book, McMafia. And you can hear the interview that we did about that on our website as well. And Misha Glennie, thank you very, very much for giving us some of your time.
You're more than welcome. It's been a pleasure, as always, and I'll be back again soon, I hope.
All right.
Support comes from Subaru of Champaign County, located on Route 45 in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieved zero landfill status, with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
Oh, I should try my microphone. Here we should acknowledge another very important source of support for this station. Really, we have to say it's the most important source of support that we have, and that's you. You out there who are listening now, wherever you are. Listeners provide a huge chunk of the money that it takes to run the station. And they do that by calling, by going online, times like this, when we say, okay, we're raising money for the station, and it's the money that'll pay for next year's programming. What are you going to do here? Well, okay, you're going to go to the phone, and you're going to dial this number, 217-244-9455. And it will be a basic exchange of information, but essentially what you're going to do is I'd say I will contribute $60, $75, $125 to the radio station to help pay for the programs. And then we'll say thanks. And you can come away with the great feeling that you're not just a listener, you're also a partner. You're part of the operation here in a very active way. That's what this is all about. And right now we're raising money, and we hope that we'll hear from over 1,000 folks.
Yes, 1,200 folks by the end of this drive, and we are on the air today, Friday through Tuesday, to ask you to please pick up the phone and pledge your support to WILL. You can call 217-244-9455, or if you prefer, go to willpledge.org and make your contribution. I am pleased to have another update from Rita Schulte, our Director of Membership and Marketing. We've gotten 233 pledges so far today, which really is a fantastic first day effort and turnout. And thank you to everyone who has called in their pledge of support so far. But if you haven't, if you're waiting till later in that drive, go ahead and call us on our first day. Show us what show us that you support us. Show us what public radio means to you. That's 217-244-9455.
And I'm really pleased to say that we've been doing this particular program, this show, Focus, for 30 years. We've been on the air 30 years this year with an incredible range of guests, and we've given people the opportunity to have some direct access to national-level guests. And we're really very happy about that. And people tell us that they appreciate that. So what we're just trying to turn around and say, well, great. We like the vote of confidence. We like to know that you like the show. But there's one other thing we'd like you to do.
That is pick up your phone right now and please contribute. Show us that you support programs like Focus, that Focus is important to you. We certainly think that Focus is an important service that we provide our community. And you show us that you support Focus as well by calling in your pledge of support right now. If you would like to show your true support of Focus, please consider calling in with a pledge of $75. With that $75 gift, we are happy to provide you a 30th anniversary leather bookmark for the Focus program. It's beautiful. It's embossed with the Illinois Public Media logo. And that thank you gift is yours for a contribution of $75.
Yeah. So one thing we like on the show is books, authors, and reading. And we thought, what could we do that would acknowledge that fact? And that's what we came up with. I don't think we've ever had anything quite like this as a thank you gift.
It's a very unique thank you gift for certain, but I think it is perfect for Focus and perfect for the Focus listener.
All right. One more time here. 217-244-9455 or willpledge.org. That's where we want you to go to show your support. Amy Stewart Ray, thank you very much for being here with
Absolutely.
Me.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
And that's it for us. Up next, The Afternoon Magazine. The host is Celeste Quinn. That's where we want you to go to show your support. Amy Stewart Ray, thank you very much for being here with
Absolutely.
Me.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me, David.
And that's it for us. Up next, The Afternoon Magazine. The host is Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. Let's turn our attention to commodity prices. In Kansas City, December wheat, 738, that's up 13. March, 751, up 11 and a half. December wheat in Chicago, 641 and a half, up 10 and three quarters. March, 674 and a quarter, up 11 and a quarter. December corn, 655 and a half, up 6. March, 665 and three quarters, up 6 and a half. May, 671 and a quarter, up 6 and three quarters. July, 675 and a quarter, up 6 and a half. November soybeans, 12.19 and a half.